Well, thanks a lot, Will, for an introduction. And yes, I'm sorry for not being able to be there. I was actually looking forward to this trip, but the Canadian embassy has taken my £100 and haven't given me a visa yet. So here I am. But yes, so thanks a lot for inviting me. So I'd like to talk about electromagnetic instability of axion stars. And I'd like to point out that, like, basically, the most of this work is actually done by Lina Chung-Juko, who's a PhD student here at King's, who is jointly supervised by myself and Dottie Marsh. So, and he's great, right? I mean, she's great. So, and we have a paper we already put out, and we are now in the process of putting another paper out. So, oops. Okay. So, right. So, axions, why should we care about it? So, before we talk about axion, we have to go back a little bit, one step back, and talk about why we care about ultra-light dark matter, which is axions is a kind of ultra-light dark matter. And the story is that we have detected gravitationally, but what are they? So we do not know the microphysics of it. And the two beautiful pictures that you can use to convince people that you have seen dark matter gravitationally is the gravitational lensing picture and the bullet cluster. The standard model for cold dark matter, because dark matter in a sense has to be cold, like if they are too hot, galaxies cannot form, is WIMP. You know, the standard is like the poster child of dark matter for many, many years. And it has this so-called small scales problem. I mean, if you talk to many people will have different opinions about how big a problem it is. But generally, it can be like encapsulated in this following graph, right? So if you take simulations of cold dark matter, you will see that the density of a galaxy follows this blue line. So this is, if you like, the density profile, and it keep going up. If it goes down to zero radius, then the density will keep going up. And this is just, the reason is simple. The reason is that cold dark matter or WIM has no pressure support. Its sound speed is zero, so it have no Jeans length, so it just want to collapse. It just want to just keep forming denser and denser cores. But if you look at the data generally give you this orange line, which says that at some point at around 1 kiloparsec scale, your galaxy's density start to flatten out. It doesn't keep going up as you would have expected if it's just cold dark matter or with no sound speed. So this is so-called small scales problem, right? So it occurs around 1 kiloparsec scale. To solve this problem, roughly, I mean, to solve this problem, what you want is a cold dark matter that has some kind of pressure support kicking in around 1 kiloparsec scale. So if you like, the cold dark matter just collapse everything in the center. But if you have some new kind of dark matter that can gives you some Jeans pressure at around 1 kiloparsec, then you have solved the cold dark matter problem. You solve the small scale problem. So in the light, and the second word here about ultra light dark matter is that it's ultra light, so it's very, very low mass. So it's low mass, which means that it needs large occupation numbers. And if you large occupation numbers, then it has to be bosonic, because if it's fermionic, you cannot stuff sufficient number of them to actually solve the dark matter problem. So if they are bosonic with large occupation numbers, then the physics of it can be described by just simple classical scalar field. So if you want to solve the dynamics of ultralight dark matter, you just solve the Kleinggordon equation. You know, boson scalars are bosons. You can have vectors, but right now we just talk about bosons, and you solve Einstein's equations, and then you can understand the dynamics of these things. So you can have complex scalars, you have vectors. In this talk, I will mostly talk about just real scalars. So how does a scalar field here like create pressure support? I mean, there are many ways of like saying the same thing, but the way that I like to picture it is to think in terms of just a scalar field. So if you have a scalar field with some mass m, what a scalar field wants to do when you set them up like Gaussian like this is just one spread. It oscillates, and you want to it wants to spread out, if you like. It just wants to. This is like one of those problems in quantum mechanics where you're asked to solve, write down the wave function of a Gaussian, and then you say, okay, evolve this, and you'll find that the Gaussian just want to spread, right? So all scalar fields just want to spread. So if you like, this spreading is like pushing, right? So like pressure pushing the scalar field out. So this arrow here is just like pushing the scalar field out. So it's acts sort of like a pressure. But then if you turn on gravity, so then gravity want to keep them back together. So this dotted lines is gravity. Oops. So this dotted line is gravity. So this competition between the scalar gradient pressure, this is what I call them, and gravity can gives you a chance of forming self-gravitating objects. Right? So this is basically why scalar fields on its own actually has some sort of a Jeans length. It has pressure. It's not like cold dark matter where everything will just collapse into the middle. So and this length, Jeans length, you can compute, right? It's roughly a de Broglie wavelength of this of the scalar field is g over rho, so it scales like the density of the ambient density to the power one minus four and mass to the one mass to the one minus one half, right? So you can compute the Jeans length, and then if you plug in the numbers and you say, okay, well, I want stuff that can give me 1 kiloparsec scale pressure support, and with the density, ambient density that describe dark matter in the universe, then you have rho, and you know what the Jeans length Jeans is, then you can calculate what little m is, and you find that the m is 10 to the minus 22 EV. So it's an extremely light particle. And this was first pointed out by this classic paper by Hu Wen and Hu Bukama and Kruzinov in 2000. And they gave it the name fuzzy dark matter, because the idea is that the dark matter particles are sort of spread out. They're not really like cold dark fermions where it is point cloud. It's just some sort of fuzz. The scalar fields act like fuzz, if you like. And the picture that you want to have is that it forms sort of galactic halo of ambient dark matter with the galaxy embedded in the middle. It's a bit sad that now people don't really call it the fuzzy dark matter, because I thought the name was it's quite cool, but people just call it ultra light dark matter now. So this is interesting. So does it actually work? And in 2014, you can do large-scale numerical simulations. So all of you have probably seen numerical simulations of this generated by Gadget, where they have this n-body simulations. We start with like n-body particles or massive particles and let them evolve, and you form all this cosmic web, and you look at the structure and you compare to your observations and say, aha, this is the universe that we see in, and it's described by cold dark matter. You can do the exact same simulations, but instead of using cold dark matter particle, you do it with scalar fields. And it was done by Shive in 2014. And what they did is that they did these two simulations. They compared the cold dark matter simulations with the scalar field simulation on the left-hand side. And if they start with the same initial density perturbations, you can see that they form basically the same structure in the larger scale. Right. What I mean by the larger scale is that if you look at the left-hand scale, left side plot, where it's a scalar, it's very, very smooth. But on the right-hand side, it's very, very coarse grain, right? It's very coarse. And this is not a function of resolution. It's a function that in cold dark matter, just keep falling and forming and smaller structure, while in the scalar field dark matter, there is a scale that stop it from, if there's a scale that smooth it out. That's basically its Jeans scale. So it's smoothed it out. But you can see that at the larger scale, they form exactly the same thing. So the difference will be in small scales. And that's what you want, right? You want it to solve, if you like, the small scale problem of dark matter. So one of the things that, so then it sort of generates a lot of interest in like looking for ultralight scalar field or bosons dark matter. And people ask, okay, where can these things come from? One of the more motivated, I mean, I will use the word motivated with quotation marks, really I should put quotation marks here, is axions. So people look for axions. Axions were originally motivated by attempts to solve the CP problem, but now people have generalized it, quote unquote, generalized it in such a way that you don't really care that about solving the CP problem. You just want some potential that give you a scalar field that you can say is roughly motivated. So for example, you can that if you believe in string theory, they will have generate lots and lots of axions. And one of them could have, the mass of this string theory, the string theory axions are not really constrained in any way. So you have basic m, little m, the mass of the axion is basically a free parameter. And roughly, axion is really usually a complex scalar field with a U1 potential, but it's a tilted, it's like a tilted Mexican hat. And the what we usually call this axion in our model, this real phi scalar field, is really the angular degree of freedom, this degree of freedom that runs around the rim of the hat. And because it's tilted, there is some point here, which is its minimum. So if the perturbation of phi is small, then it basically oscillates around this minimum. So at some small change in phi, you would expect it to be just look like a m squared phi squared potential. And the next leading order term will be lambda phi 4, and you can keep computing the all the additional interaction terms. But in general, you can either simulate it on the right-hand side, or if you want to be more general, you can just simulate with your entire cosine potential. So it's a scalar field. It has a mass, and as I say, it can support itself. It can form self-gravitating objects, and here's how it looks like. It's a real scalar field, so it oscillates. It doesn't stay constant. It oscillates. Even though the scalar field is oscillate, you can find solutions where the stress tensor actually is not a function of time. So you can find statics, or at least quasi-static solutions. And this people have given it many, many names. People call it boson stars, oscillatons, soliton stars. Nobody actually agrees on the nomenclature. What I usually like to call them is that the real scalar fields are oscillatons, and then the complex ones are boson stars. But it's just really what I call them, and people can call them whatever they want to call them. So you have these stars, and you can say, okay, well, what are their mass? What are their properties? So to describe that, let's make some definitions. So these stars can be very, very compact or very, very diffuse. It depends on how relativistic it is. I will explain it a little bit later. But let's just define this parameter that's called compactness, and is de divide defined to be the GM over R. So we might notice that if it's a black hole, then C is 0.5, right? So black hole has the structural radius of black hole is 2 GM. So for a black hole, the compactness is 0.5. So C is, the black hole is 0.5. And for neutron stars, they're roughly around 0.2. So for a boson star or an axion stars, you can find solutions or like I'm just solutions. I'm not doesn't necessarily have to be stable. Solutions between like zero, which is very, very diffuse, not compact at all, or around 0.5, right? Or not really 0.5, but close to 0.5, and this would be relativistic. So this will be very, very highly compact axion stars. But as I said, they are not they are solutions, but they don't have to be stable. And most models become unstable around 0.1 to 0.3. It's sort of like a horse race to try to find the models with higher compactness. And the reason is that we want to know whether or not you can actually get to 0.5, right? So can you smoothly map a set of solutions of your compact axion star or compact objects to that of a black hole? Is it smooth? Is there going to be is transition from stars, the solution can transition from stars to black hole in a smooth way? And my personal suspicion is no, but I don't really know the answer to this. So as I said, right, you can make them to be extremely diffuse, or you can make them to be extremely compact. And non-compact stars are non-relativistic. The compactness is much less than one. They can be very, very massive. And these are the usual stars or solitons or whatever you would call them that is usually used to model like ambient dark matter. So they're very, very big. They're very, very massive. But because they're so big, their density is very low. So they can be as low as the ambient dark matter. And usually the radius of this thing is much bigger than the inverse of the mass scale of the axions. But you can also form them to be extremely compact. So you can just stuff a lot of them together and find some stable relativistic stars where the compactness is order 0.1. And in this case, you'll find that the radius is roughly of order 1 over m, and the mass is roughly m Planck square over m. And this is m Planck square over little m, where little m is the mass of the axion. And after, I think it was Vitor Cardoso who started calling them exotic compact objects, and it seems they have stuck. So people have started calling these things exotic compact objects. They're compact objects, but not really the usual compact objects like neutron star, but the exotic ones. So you can notice that this mass depends on the inverse of the mass of the axion, and you can say, okay, well, what is little m when m is of the solar mass? And why are we interested in this number is because, well, we have gravitational wave detectors that's tuned to look for gravitational wave around this mass. So and you plug that in, and you find a little m is 10 to the minus 11 eV. And if you look at the literature, this is often the number that people focus on. And not because there's any theoretical reason why this number is interesting. It's just because this is the range where we have detectors that can look for those. So when LISA turns on, for example, we will have another window that we can look for, and we probably expect a lot more papers on different little ends, if you like. So, and you can, and these things, as I said, can be unstable, and then you can check for stability levels. And one of the things that you can do is that you can construct the stars. You can just build that numerically, and then you let it run and see whether or not they will collapse into a black hole, or they diffuse. They would disperse into like scalar radiation. They are, so they don't collapse, but they just radiate themselves out into infinity, or they stay stable, right? So, and you can, because in axions you have a two parameters. If you like, you have the little mass of the axion, and in the second order term, if you include the interaction, you have the so-called axion decay constant. So you have these two parameters, and you can look for the phase space, if you like, of these solutions. And here, this is what we did, right? So we just run a bunch of simulation and see whether or not they are stable. And we find that, you know, at this region on top here is a stable axion star, and this region is a black hole, and this region is dispersed. So there's some point here where we call it a triple point, and you turns out that you can actually sort of like roughly and literally derive the triple point, which is what was very cool. We did not know that when we wrote the paper, and then people say, "Oh yeah, no, you can actually derive them." So great, you know, we have saved us a lot of time simulating, but it's really nice to have the results, numerical results checked by people who basically know more analytics than we do. So before I go to talk about the electromagnetic instability, I just want to spend a little bit more time. What time do I have? Okay, I have some time. Talking about what are the difference between the axion stars with black holes and neutron stars, right? So what are they? You know, often early on in the like early as in the just a few years ago, people thought that axion stars can mimic black holes, right? So the idea is that could it be that the gravitational wave solution that you saw in the LVK detections are not really black holes but some crazy exotic compact objects? And I think the story has become a lot more muddled now, and I just want to give you an idea about why it's more muddled. So I think the first difference between a boson star or axion star and black hole and neutron star is that it's squishy, right? So in a sense that black holes are maximally rigid, it always says that gravity is the most rigid thing in the entire universe. And if you have a black hole, then tidal force do not deform them. If like Love number is zero, if you put a black hole and you apply a tidal force, it will stay maximally rigid. It doesn't deform. Well, boson stars are squishy, right? So if the bosons do not experience Pauli exclusion principle, so if you apply a tidal force, then it will deform. And this has observational consequences, right? In the sense that when you collide two of them, you collide two boson stars, they when so they have more they, so they're more squishy, so they can deform a lot more. If they deform a lot more, then when the apparent horizon form, the horizon could be a lot more non-spherical, and then you should kind of expect to see more gravitational waves. And actually, this is what we saw. And I'll show you some I might show you some I might show you some results, but I think I will show you some results. But I think we have done a lot more of this simulation recently, and we definitely have confirmed that this is true. And then the question is that, well, is there a relationship between Love number and gravitational wave production, right? So it'd be really nice if we can get a sense of, like, just give me an object and then calculate a Love number and then tell us what the gravitational wave energy would be if you merge them. So yeah, okay, I will actually show you. So here's a plot, right? So here's a plot where you just collide two equal mass boson star versus equal mass black hole, and exactly the same initial condition, except that you replace one of them with black hole and one of them with boson star, and you find that this is the power generated. And for black hole, it is, you know, here's the blue line is the black hole, and the dotted line is the boson star. So it generates at least twice as much gravitational wave energy, and we have recently discovered that this is actually not even the most this is not even the most optimistic case. You can get a lot more gravitational waves, but we are in the middle of like checking this result actually true. So that's one thing. So the other thing is that unlike black holes, which if you like, once black holes is formed, is the most stable object in the entire universe. It just doesn't change anymore. Black holes is the end state, if you like. But boson stars have instability, right? So as an instability, it has a high compactness. So if you like, this is a plot of the mass of the boson star as a function of compactness. And if you notice that the mass increase up to like when compactness about 0.14, and then it started to turn over. And this point, if you like, is a critical point. In the sense that if you try to construct boson star around this point, which you can write down a solution and create it and put inside a simulation and wait. And you wait for a little bit and then you collapse into a black hole, right? So they are basically unstable. So you can check that they are unstable. And you can ask, okay, where does this point come from? There are some analytic estimates of it, but really the first time when you see it, you probably have to do numerics to check for it. And this has observational consequences, right? Because it means that if you make stars that are make stars that are boson stars that are unstable, then they will never get a chance to collide as boson stars. So here's a plot that I really like, which is that you plot mergers of hadron mergers of two equal mass boson stars, and you plot it as a function of compactness, and you start everything being the same, right? So you start with the same distance, you start with no velocity, you just let them collide and calculate the gravitational wave that you produce. And you find that at this red region where you make that, you can notice that as you increase the compactness, the energy actually increases. And this dotted line here is actually the gravitational wave that you get from just black hole. So as I said, right, at sufficiently high compactness, you actually generate more gravitational wave than black hole case. But at some point, it drops right down back to black hole again. So what happened here? So what happened here is because the boson stars are unstable, as they get close to each other, the tidal forces of the companion star actually cause a collapse. So they actually collapse into a black hole before they merge. So that's why you get back the black hole case. So there's some sort of like a transition here. And we have been trying to understand whether this transition, if we like, is first order or second order, if it's smooth or it's actually it's actually smooth or it's actually just a discontinuity. So and so far we are seeing, depending on the model we're using, we are seeing some of them are first order and some of them are second order. So we're not quite sure what's going on. It's very confusing, but we are investigating this region. And the third thing between the boson star and black hole and neutron star is spin. So unlike black holes, right? So boson stars are created, if you have the as a microscopic description, it is a scalar field, and scalar field must be continuous around a sphere, so it must be quantized, right? If you have a function that's continuous, then it must have then it must be quantized. It's just a, it's a simple function of mathematics. It's not even quantum mechanics. It's just a function of that. If you solve any smooth function on a compact space, it has to be, you know, it has to have a integer wave numbers. And the question is that, can you find stable spinning boson stars? And this has been a big question for a long time, and whether or not you can find analytical or numerical. There are some papers, like for example, Sanchez Grau, that says that no, it's not stable. But I think Will and Niels recently have put up several papers that say no, you actually can find stable spinning boson stars. So this is a really an interesting area of research, and to understand at what regime where you can find stable spinning boson star solutions. So it's not an easy problem, and I think Niels and Will can tell you how hard it is. And finally is the post-merger signals of black holes. So black hole end states are boring. I mean, it's crazy that in this time we say black holes are boring, but we see a lot of black holes and we haven't seen any boson stars. So in a sense, black holes are boring because black holes is, if you like, the final end. We want to form black holes, it rings down and it stays a black hole and there's nothing happens after that. Well, boson star end states are exciting in a sense that if you collide them, if you, I'm showing a movie, if you collide them and they merge and they don't form a black hole, and what happens is you have this really highly excited spinning boson star that just continuously generate gravitational waves, right? So they will just keep going. They will keep going, they keep going. It will start to slow down, but the time scale for it to radiate all the excited energy is quite long. I don't think, and we definitely never have actually seen the bo any boson any excited boson star radiate away until it becomes non-excited again. It just takes a long time. But what happened is that this gravitation this excited boson star is not spherically symmetric, so you just generate gravitational wave, and you can just keep running them and generate a gravitational wave from it. And this is an epic simulation by Robin. Robin Croft, he's now a postdoc in I think in Pisa, but he just somehow managed to just run a simulation that's stable and convergent tested that you can get gravitational wave of this crazy highly excited boson star for a long time, right? So I think this is just amazing epic simulation. I don't know how he managed to do it, but the idea here is that after merger you will not just get silence. Like if you have seen boson star and neutron star, they're just silence, right? But boson star, sorry, black hole or neutron star. In boson star, if you merge them, they will, and if they don't form a black hole, then what you have is this ringing, this constant screaming, if you like, of gravitational wave signal that's fairly long lived. It's as long as the time it takes for it to relax back into its non-excited state, and takes a really, really long time. And it's somewhat periodic, so which means that we have a good hope of detecting them, even though the signal might be small, because it's long lived, right? It's long lived means that you can actually try to beat down the noise by just integrating it for a long, long time. So and all these head-on mergers, or at least collisions with some impact parameter. Well, what about black boson star in spirals, right? So this is an extremely difficult problem, as you know, again, Will and Niels have done a lot of work on it recently, and we are ourselves also working on it. But this is, if you like, the gold standard of boson star research. It's like you want to be able to set up initial conditions of boson star, which you know what the which you know what initial conditions are, that you're not plagued by like and physical oscillation and things like that. And this, I think, is still an unsolved problem until, unless of course we've already solved it and he's already writing a paper on it. So okay, so this is just my sort of like my background on boson star. And in the last, the next like 20 minutes or 25 minutes, I'm going to talk about like this, what happened when axions and photons are coupled together and its consequences. So why do you couple them, right? So again, you know, I mean, if I want to be cynical, you couple them, you can write new papers, but they are expected, right? And unless if you have these extrascalar fields flying around, unless you have some symmetry that protects any coupling, you should expect some kind of couplings between the axion or the ultralight boson with any standard model particles. For example, in the QCD axion, you have a generic coupling between the scalar with the FF dual, if you like, the Chern, it's called the Chern-Simons coupling, the electromagnetic field, and it's generated by this axion mixing with pions. For the other exotic axions, therefore, if you have some model of string theory that predict your axions, then you can compute them, right? So if you have your fundamental theory, if you have your UV computed theory, then you can just turn the crank and calculate what the coupling should be. So and this is not just for fun, right? This is, if you like, if you cannot see axion, then if you cannot see axion, then you might as well just give up in a sense. But you, if you have to connect, if you have a coupling to electromagnetic waves, then, or electromagnetism, then you can hope to detect them by looking at the electromagnetic spectrum of these objects. And this is actually like people actually put money into it. I mean, people, these are the primary channel for direct detection experiments, like the CASS, CASPER, IXO. These are all like actual experiments with money has been put in to try to look for axions, right? So, and the idea is that this all these experiments based on this idea that there is a photon-photon coupling. But if you, so a phi field can get converted into two photons, like two photon particles. But if you apply a very, very strong magnetic field, then what you really want is then the Feynman diagram just looks like the phi being converted into one photon. So all these things are basically giant magnets, right? Giant magnets with a photon detector at the end, and you point at the sun, or you point at things that you hope there are axions flying through it, and you hope to see some photons, if you like. So this is if you have a like strong magnetic field. And this another way of seeing it, instead of building like giant magnets, what you can do is that hope that nature give you giant magnets, and nature can give you giant magnets in the form of a neutron star that has a magnetic field. So if you like a magnetar, and if you have a magnetar that has strong magnetic field and is in spiraling into dark matter, so some intermediate mass black hole, and if the dark matter is axions, then it will interact. And so as you spin down, you will see some gravitational waves from the interaction of the neutron star with the black hole. So they are both compact objects, so they generate gravitational wave. But because the neutron star is also have a magnet, it's also a magnet, so it will convert some of the black holes into photons. And at this range, you can compute that the frequency of the electromagnetic wave is actually in the radio. So you can see some like rising radio wave. So this paper by Thomas Edwards and collaborators argue that, well, if you see a black hole, if you see like inspiring gravitational signal, look for some radio amplitude that keep going up. You know, as you go closer to the center, the density of the axions become higher, so you get a stronger radio wave signal. So that's just the so-called Primakov process, where you have a magnetic field available to you, but you don't need a magnetic field to see these effects, right? So the other thing that you can argue is the if you have that some scalar field, if your axion field is actually oscillating, then it can actually produce photons by just parametric pumping. So if there's a resonance between the oscillations of your scalar field with some frequency of electromagnetic waves, then you could in the produce the axion field can explosively decay into photons, right? I mean, this is pointed out by these people a long time ago. I mean, this is known for a while, and this is the point. The idea is that there could exist an axion photon instability. And for a while, people worry that the universe, because if you say the universe is full of axions, and axions, the frequency of the axions is depends on what's the expansion rate of the universe, and at some point, the axions will have the same oscillation frequency as the photon, and boom, the universe explodes and everybody dies because you get so much photons. But it turns out that you're sort of protected by it. So cosmological expansion changes the frequency of the axions, so you never reach that frequency, if you like. But on the other hand, if the axions are not cosmological but are localized, then you're no longer protected by cosmological expansion. So in a sense, axion star is like a star which is localized with some oscillation frequency, and as I showed you just now, they support itself by oscillating. Then this provide you a channel for parametric resonance. So I mean, here's a movie, right? So it oscillates, phi scales like sine, the phi is oscillating at roughly a frequency of m. So if there's photons flying around about the frequency of m, then could it be unstable, right? So that's the question. And the picture that you have is like it's kind of similar to similar to ex emission. So like here's the blue, the yellow bit is the axion star. It has some radius rs, and you get some photons comes in and hits a axion, and then it's the fact that it's a photon, it stimulate the emission of more photons. So phi plus gamma, phi no, gamma plus phi equals to 3 gamma. And you can ask, okay, what's the frequency of this gamma? It will be roughly the frequency of the oscillation of the phi. And you can say, okay, well, how big this object has to be. So you want the gamma to have a chance of colliding with phi. And it turns out that for that to happen, the radius of this thing have to be roughly the wavelength of the electromagnetic wave that you're trying to generate. So because in a compact stars, RS is roughly m to the inverse. So in a non-relativistic case, you can check, right? People have checked this for the non-relativistic case. You can do perturbation theory and you can calculate this. And you find that at some the it's unstable at some critical coupling, right? You notice that this resonance, the resonance depends on the coupling between the axions and the photon-axion coupling. So at some value, you expect it to be unstable, and it turns out that you can just do some fairly involved analytics to show that for non-relativistic stars, it's roughly it scales like inverse of the mass of the axion. And this will be shown by these two people, this especially the second paper, just a 2D4, so like. What about relativistic case? Well, I mean, this is like where we come in, if you like. So where we have a numerical relativity code, we are looking for nails to smash, and here's one nail, and we start smashing it, right? So we can solve it in numerical relativity, and this is work done by like most of the work is done by Lina, and she's great, right? So and the idea is that, oh well, let's set up a compact axion stars, which you know how to do. And then let's send in some photons, right? So we model the photons, not very realistically, but this is the easiest thing for us to do, as just basically a plane wave of electromagnetic wave. And we just a constant plane wave, just bathing it with a plane wave train. And we pick the frequency of this plane wave train to be about 0.1 meter, sorry, 0.1 m. So, I mean, you can change this value. It doesn't change the results. I'll tell you what happened when you change the wavelength a little bit later. And then you send it in and say, okay, well, what happens, right? So here's a code, and here we have numerical relativity. You have to show beautiful movies, and here we are, right? So on the left-hand side here is the density of the energy density of the axion, and so here you can see the axion in the middle, and on the right-hand side is the energy density of the photons. So now what we're doing is that we are sending a photon, a plane wave of photon from the right to the left. So the photons coming in from right to the left, the plane wave coming from right to left, and polarized in the x direction. So it's coming from the wave vector is coming from right to the left, and the polarization vector is pointing straight up, right? So because it's in the x direction, and the energy is very, very small, right? We put a very, very tiny seat, and I'll tell you later what happened when you change the seat. So the energy density is so low, you can't actually see it. So it's basically smaller than the key. So you know, without further ado, let's just run it. So you can see that the boson star is oscillating. And then you wait, and you wait, and you wait. And then you can start to see on the right hand side, maybe a little bit of like signal. Here we go. Here is the photons. You know, you're starting to meet. And go. And you can see on the left hand side, the boson star is starting to diffuse, so it grows in size. So it keep going, and then boom, right. And then it turns itself off, right? So the energy of the axion star has been now converted to photons. And then if you just squint your eye, you can see a little circle here. Can you see? I don't know. I mean, I can't see people. If you put up their hand if they can see this. Can you see this? I can see. I don't know if your screen is so here. If you cannot see, basically you can see, roughly speaking, the radius of the new axion star is now about this size, and this is because the mass of the axion star has decreased and the compactness of the star has actually decreased. And we know that when the compactness decreases, the radius increases. It becomes just more diffuse. So what turns off the parametric resonance is that when it becomes diffuse, it starts to move away from the resonance frequency. Because remember that this is parametric resonance, so that is like unstable bands. So if the radius of the star becomes bigger, so the oscillation frequency also starts to change. And it changes away from the resonance frequency, and then it cuts itself off. So the star is still there, and I will show you an energy density plot to show that it is actually still there. So we can do this. You know, you say, okay, well, let's what is this instability depends on? Does it depend on G, the axion photon coupling, GA gamma? And obviously it does, and how does it depend on it? And what we did is that we just vary the compactness or vary the mass, we keep the mass fixed. And then we vary the compactness. So we make the star slightly less compact, slightly more compact, and vary the mass this way. And then just simulate a bunch of them and see which one of them is stable and which one is unstable. And then this is each. So this arrow pointing down is an unstable star, and these dots are just stable stars. And you can draw a line straight through. And then you can calculate what G alpha, this G alpha gamma, or GA gamma is a function of the mass of the star, and it scales like mass to the -135. And just compare this with the non-relativistic scale, which is like scales to the -1. So there are two things here, right? So one is independent of M. I mean, don't be confused. And I actually absolutely regret putting the plot out in our paper this way when we put a little M here. And the reason we put a M here is just we want to scale to 10 to the -11 because this is what people care about. Because this is where the LIGO sensitivity is. But this is actually completely independent of M. This is just some units that I've chose to make to come out with some numbers, if you like. So if you like, the better way of plotting it is not a function of MS, it's a really should be a function of compactness. But because the non-relativistic people have chosen the MS to be the parameter they want to plot, so we just have to follow them. Like we're just following what they're doing. So and the decay is exponentially quick, right? I mean, as you can see from the movie, it just stays there and then boom, it goes. So here is a total energy plot on the y-axis, and the x-axis is time in units of 1 over m. And you can see that initially the scalar field energy. So here's the black line is for a g alpha gamma that is in the stable regime. So the black line is where the scalar energy just stay constant. It just doesn't do anything. The scalar field just stays there. Nothing happens. You can run it for a little bit longer. Until it ran out of computational time, it still stays there. But then if you start to increase G, the coupling, then it will start to decay. So the red and blue depends, tells the red and blue are just two different coupling strengths. And you find that if for stage for G14, you find that at some point the scalar field decay, but it doesn't decay all the way. It decays until the stars expand and dilute and goes out of the resonance band and it stays constant again. You can see from the electromagnetic energy also goes up and then come back down. Now you can ask, well, why is the energy going down? And the energy going down is because it's just numerics. So we have checked by increasing the resolution to see that the modes actually don't decrease as much when you increase the resolution. And the reason is that because they are photons and they're just electromagnetic waves, they have high frequency modes, and the high frequency modes actually get killed by the resolution. So we lose energy by just in terms of resolution. And you can just do the same simulation with just high resolution, and you see that it doesn't go down. And we have checked that. And but they are just incredibly expensive simulation to do, so we just don't do it for all the simulation that we did. And you've increased the coupling strength. Oops. If you increase the coupling strength, then the scalar field, just the core itself. Sorry, is there a question?
Yes, hi Eugene. A quick question. What about the plasma frequency of the medium? Because if these are very low frequency photons, they cannot really be emitted.
Say again, Anyash, I didn't quite hear you. Can you say that again?
Frequency of the medium.
We don't have any plasma here. We just have a plain electromagnetic wave. I see your point, right? The plasma frequency sort of suppresses this, but this is just we have no there's no nothing except a boson star and a plane wave.
But in terms of realistic situations, don't you expect the frequency of these photons to be much lower than the plasma frequency?
Much lower than the plasma frequency. Lower or higher, I do not know, but it won't be the same, I think. So I don't recall the whether or not it the higher plasma frequency suppresses it or lower plasma frequency suppresses it. I just don't have it in at all in my head. But it won't be the same. I mean, we are not simulating that. This is a very good question, right? This in fact people would it is a good thing to challenge that does the plasma actually stop the decay from happening. And I actually don't have a good answer to that at this moment, but right now we don't actually simulate that.
Thank you.
No worries. So then you can calculate the rate decay half-life, if like how long does it take to decay. It clearly depends on the coupling constant, and you can show that it's roughly, g to the minus 0.87. And the time to decay depends on the amplitude of the seed, and it only depends on the log of the amplitude. And this means that it doesn't matter how small the photon energy is, if you like, it will cause a Pyramid resonance, because the thing is that when you reach resonance, it's just exponential. So it doesn't matter how small the energy is, it will get there, and get there not an exponentially small energy doesn't mean an exponentially small long time for it to decay. It's just a log of exponential. So it actually, if you have some photons in the right frequency, they will cause it to decay. So and the emission is isotropic. So I write here pseudo-isotropic because we have actually compute the entire spectrum. Entire we haven't at this stage when we wrote this paper, we haven't computed the energy as a function of spherical harmonic. We just took, if you like, the x, y, and z direction of the polarization. And so this is the power spectrum of the electromagnetic wave that's emitted, and the y-axis is just a power spectrum, and the x-axis is the wave mode. And this point here, this dotted line here is our input, right? So this is our input, and it's electromagnetic wave polarized in the x direction. And after some time, after the decay has happened, you find that most of the energy is now hiding inside this point, with the wavelength around points around let's say one, two, three, four, around let me see, 1, 2, 3. So it's around the frequency here, which is roughly the scale of the boson star, which is in a sense what we expected it to be. And also it's pseudo-isotropic, right? So even though the electromagnetic wave we send in is basically highly polarized, or basically literally polarized in just one direction, the polarization or the spectrum is isotropic. And it's not surprising because the energy of the boson star initially is spherically symmetric. And most of the energy that comes from the decay is comes from the boson star, which is spherically symmetric. So you should expect energy in all directions and not just in the polarized modes. So this is not in the paper. This is recently, this took Lina, poor Lina, 7 months to get it right, because it was really, really hard calculation to do. You can try to calculate the gravitational wave of it, and it's really messy because you have all this electromagnetic wave all flying around. and we got some results, and we are not confident in it, and eventually we beat it. We figure out a way, or at least she figure out a way to actually extract this and convergen tested this. So on the left hand side is the gravitational waveform of the signal, and this you can see that this in the middle is basically where the decay happens. And you notice that that here's the real. So if you like, for those who are not familiar with this, you can sort of like look at the real and imaginary component of this R psi 4 parameter. So this R psi 4 parameter is roughly speaking the strain, the second derivative of the strain. So think of the metric perturbation H double dot is basically R psi 4. Right. So and this is the parameter, this is the thing that we extract from our simulations. And then if you want the strain, you just integrate it twice. But the strain itself, the psi 4 itself have both real and imaginary components. And roughly speaking, the real and imaginary components are the plus and the cross modes of the gravitational waves. And if for a thing that is actually symmetric, and usually you just expect the real component of the psi 4. But here, because the electromagnetic wave actually breaks the symmetry, you actually generate quite a lot of the other modes. Right? So both the plus and cross modes are actually equally represented. And you can calculate and then you have the electromagnetic wave that is emitted by the decay, and also the scalar fields also get emitted. And here on the right hand side is just the flux. And what this is that we take a sphere, we collect all the energy that is the flux of the electromagnetic and the scalar radiation coming out of the axion stars on a sphere, and then plot this out. And I put here arbitrary units because we haven't quite figured out what the units is. And this is just done like just a few days ago. So we haven't quite figured out what the units is. But I mean, I think it's just basically the energy. So but we are just not confident. So I put arbitrary units here for now. And you can see that the frequency of the electromagnetic flux basically track that of the gravitational waves. Wow, the scalar is further away, right? So what's going on here? It's further away because we are collecting the energy at some fixed radius. So, but the scalar, remember, has mass, right? So gravitational wave and electromagnetic wave have no mass. So they just emit like speed of light, while the scalar modes have mass. So they actually, so when a field has mass, the velocity of the modes depends on the wave vector itself. So it spreads out. So because after some, so it takes one, it takes longer to get to the collection, the radius where you collect all the energy. And two, because you have multiple modes, you don't just have one wave mode, you have multiple modes, and each of them travel at different speed. So they start to mix up and you see all this much higher oscillation because the modes are just the different modes are just mixing them up now. So we stupidly stop the simulation at this stage and we have to continue and see how it works. But we expect it just to just go up and then eventually it dies off, because once the radiation stops, it just becomes a static solution again. Right.
Just on the previous slide, was that a particular spherical harmonic of psi 4 that you're showing us?
This is L2 M0 mode. So So the left hand side is L2 zero mode, and this is just flux, right? This is not spherical. This is not haven't been decomposed into anything. This is just the energy flux coming out. Okay, so what happened, right? So now you say that, okay, well, if photons can cause them to destabilize, can they actually exist in the universe, right? So and there's photons everywhere. In fact, there are photons everywhere because they're the CMB. So you can do a quick energetic calculation, and I will tell you what I did, and I'll tell you why there are some reasons to doubt that this might not be correct, although I think it's open to questions. So for example, if you take the mass of the axion to be 10 to the 11, 10 to minus 11 EV, because this is gives you the mass of the boson star of the solar mass, which we care about, then you can just calculate what the G, what's the critical coupling is. If you put in this critical coupling of 16 and Planck inverse, you find that from CMB photons alone, it takes about 0.05 seconds to decay. So if you like, there should be no compact axion stars in the LVK sensitive range if this the photon axion coupling of this is 16 inverse amp.
May I ask, like, what's the So like you are saying, like all of this energy in the axion star, like all the one of it turns into electromagnetic radiation.
No, not all of them. It would go. Let me show you this.
So the question I have is how big is the electric field at this time?
Sorry?
How big would be the electric field of like this photon laser at this time?
Oh, you mean like during the decay?
Yeah, during the decay. Like what's the magnetic strength?
Yeah, this will be what it is. This is the flux. So you just collect the flux, and this is the amplitude.
So you mean like all the one of the energy is going to this electromagnetic field?
Yeah, exactly. If you look at this plot, right? So this is the scale.
So then, like I think, like you have other instability to worry about when you have such a large B field. Like what you are talking about is not correct.
You mean like what you mean by large B field? These are not really B field. These are just photons. Like these are just
yeah. It's photons, right? Like it's photons which are basically electromagnetic field. So you have electromagnetic field with a extreme strength, right? Like you have energy, like a field strength is of order like 100 MeV.
Mm-hmm.
So like this field won't like, as like what Nayesh was asking, like this field won't like stay there.
What field won't stay, the electromagnetic field or the scalar field?
Yeah, you cannot maintain like an electromagnetic field of order like 100, like 100 MeV to the 4.
Like it doesn't, right? It just radiated away. I mean, this simulation as all the we solved the whole equation in full, right? We solved the electromagnetic equations, we solved the GR equation, we solved
So I'm asking, like, what's the strength of the electromagnetic field can you get in the system?
I don't know the number because this is arbitrary units, but once we figure out what the units is, I can tell you. But I can tell you what the energy density is, how much energy is emitted and is coming from here. Yeah, so this is the energy, right? So this is, if you like, the so this is the total energy in the electromagnetic field. This is like just integrating all the electromagnetic field in the box.
So basically, like you are taking like some like solar mass of energy, like within some 10 to minus 11 EV, like inverse land scale. You can compute what the electric field strength is, and that if electric field strength, I don't think it can be a stable electric field.
But it's not a stable
in the universe.
No, but it's not but it's not a stable electric field. I don't really care if it's stable. It's just radiation, right? It just get emitted to the universe and hit somebody.
No, I'm saying like once you have charged particles in the system, then like your instability will be saturated.
Oh, you mean like if there's some other stuff other than just what we put in?
Yeah, like you have electrons in the universe.
Oh yeah. No, I think you're right. I don't think I just saying that we haven't thought about that, right? So I don't think we have thought about that, but it's a good point, right? I mean, we haven't thought about plasma at all, basically. We just our system is just a scalar field, ENM, and gravity, and no electrons and nothing, right? So and in fact, our argument is that we shouldn't be able to form this thing in the first place because they are just not stable. If they are not stable, they shouldn't be there in the first place. So even though
because you are saying like it will have like a parametric resonance. I'm telling you that the parametric resonance will be shut off way before you reach the energy density where like it will matter for your simulation.
If there's electrons, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know about that, but I will take your advice and I will look it up. I just don't know the answer with a plasma frequency. That is something that I haven't thought very deeply about.
Okay.
All right, very good. So, so people care about all these things in the sense that if this are unstable, so would you dump, if you believe in this, right? I mean, I'm not quite sure I believe in this, but if you believe in this, then you're saying that all this radiation will get dumped into the universe, and then this will heat up an intergalactic medium and maybe change the CMB optical depth, right? So people care about things like this. So the next question is that what about mergers, right? So what happened in mergers? So if objects like this, if for example if you have something, if you say for example your critical coupling is less than that of the critical coupling, then you can have these objects. They are stable, you know, they would, and they fly around, and suppose one this day one meet another friend and they merge. And when they merge, they usually form something that's more massive. But they're more massive means that they're more slightly more compact. And maybe this will actually cause them to go past the critical coupling. So what happened there? So can they become unstable? Right? So I mean, we thought, okay, well, this is a fun thing to do. Let's just simulate it and see what happens. So here's what happened, right? So you simulate it. So you run them. So against, sorry, oops. Right. So on the left hand side is just against the energy density. You can see now there are two stars, and the right hand side against the energy density of the radiation. And then you run them, and then they come in, they merge, and then they form this highly excited thing. And then you see, oh, they start to decay, and it's much in the sense it seems to decay much faster than the one that we have in the single star case. And I think it's just a function of the mass scale that we're using. So I don't think there's anything less special about that. And we can show you the gravitational wave if you like. So here we are, right? So this is again the energy density. Like, so the red line is just the electromagnetic wave. So it's zero initially. And the scalar is here, so the scalar is a blue line, and this little bump here is a merger, and this bump here is not, it is really a artifact of the way we calculate the integrated energy. It's just that we have integrated it blindly. We haven't normalized for the fact that our volume has changed because of compression or anything. So this is not really a physical bump, but at least the bump tells us where the merger is, but what you see is that during a merger, there's no electromagnetic wave, right? During the merger process, nothing happens. So even we were hoping to see some burst of electromagnetic wave, but we see nothing. So it's a bit disappointing. But then we move for a little bit, and then again it kicks on, the resonance kicks in, and then it starts to decay, and it starts to decay until it reaches some bigger, more diffuse star, and then it becomes stable again. And you can see the gravitational wave signal. So you can see that here, this little bump here. And because it is the initial configuration is just two boson star or two exon star merging, it doesn't have any cross mode, you don't have plus mode. So you can see a little bump here. You can zoom in and see a little bit more detail. But what you can see here is that after a while, they decay, and you see this ginormous burst of gravitational wave. And you can compute the energy of this guy compared to the merger, and you find it's actually about 10 times more. So it's a little bit more energetic for it to die than for it to merge. And during the merger, as I said, right, so because your electromagnetic wave break the symmetry, you actually see both cross and plus modes. So basically this is it, right? We are now in the process where we're writing a paper on this. But I think I'm like running out of time, so I'm gonna leave my summary plot here. And happy to take any questions. Thanks for listening.
All right, let's see. Yeah, so in the case of the boson stars colliding, mm-hmm. you said that the signal lasts a long time afterward, if I remember. Is that right?
Would the signal last a long time afterward?
Well, there's this initial burst, and then there's this long oscillation afterward.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Sorry. So I was thinking of some other thing. So you're saying... this one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right there. So I just, have you collided a boson star with a black hole? And if so, what happens? Do you still get a long signal?
We haven't ourselves, but other people have. But I think usually when you collide a boson star with a black hole, the black hole just eats up the boson star and just become a bigger black hole and possibly spinning black hole. And sometimes you see some scalar field that's orbiting the black hole, but I don't recall whether or not they have. Maybe they have, but I just don't remember a strong recollection of what the gravitational wave signal should be for that. But usually, when you collide a black hole with a boson star, most of the boson gets eaten up by the black hole.
That's what I would expect, but it's not obvious to me if you get a long-lived gravity wave signal or not.
I don't know either.
I guess
boson star and tiny black hole.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's the opposite. So yeah.
I was thinking of a comparable, but you're right. It would care about the relative size. That's certainly true.
But then black hole could not keep its hair, so it won't have that.
Yeah, okay, I guess that's right. And the other thing I wondered is what sets the, you have in the case of these axion stars that get hit by a photon or by light,
light, and then they oscillate and decay into photons, but then they settle down to a more diffuse object. What sets the scale? Yeah, maybe the previous slide?
This one?
What sets the scale of where the thing stabilizes? Is some trade-off between gravity and the decay? Why does it settle down at the energy that it does?
I think it sets the scale. I think it sets it's the scale is kind of set by your incoming wave. So what you want is your photon, your plane wave, or your electromagnetic train to be in the resonance band of the oscillation of the boson star, of the exon star. And that frequency depends on the size of it. So if you set the electromagnetic wave initially to be inside the resonance band, then it will resonate and it will decay. And when it decays, it loses energy. And when the boson star loses energy, it becomes bigger and more diffuse. And it also slows down the frequency, the oscillation frequency. It might go out of the resonance band, then it stops. So that basically sets the scale of when it cuts off. The fact that the electromagnetic wave, the oscillation of the boson star is no longer in the resonance band. So in the parametric resonance, the not all frequencies are unstable. There are just like bands of unstable frequency, which you can calculate.
Okay, so the size of the end product cares about that.
Yeah, exactly. It would get itself cut off when the resonance band when the size of the boson star is away from the incoming
resonance thing.
Yeah, it stopped resonating, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Are there estimates of the abundance or merger rate for these objects?
Sorry, say again. Can you repeat the question, please?
It's on the same. Are there estimates of the abundance or the merger rate for these objects?
I have absolutely no idea. To be completely honest, I don't know. I think that people like Dolly, for example, have written some papers. I think it depends on what is the progenitor, what is the mechanism of the formation of these objects. And I would say that it is still up for debate. What would be the spectrum? I think this is actually one of the big open questions of exotic compact objects, is to know what is the spectrum of this object, what is the number density as a function of mass. I don't think people actually have settled on that question, so I would say I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. Maybe some people have some ideas, but I think it's still an open question. But it's a really good question, right? So we just don't know the answer to that.
What would be the formation mechanism?
I think formation mechanism depends on, I would say it depends on who you ask. I think if you ask somebody who do axions, then they would say that it will be like the symmetry breaking, like if it's like the there is an axion field and it's the symmetry breaking happens, and then you form all these axion mini clusters and they combine to make these objects. If you ask somebody like me, for example, who say, okay, well, maybe you can form axions from the end of inflation and you have preheating and the scalar field collapse to form more compact objects. So I think it depends on who you talk to. I think that what we have done is that we have tried to form this object by just collapsing. So the question is that we always start with this object being already formed, right? So the question is that, can you actually form them by collapsing them? Is there an Oppenheimer-Snyder, if you like, for boson star? And the answer is that yes. Yeah, you can just set up with some small perturbation of scalar field, and then you run your simulations, and then they will just collapse in and form an object. So the formation mechanism is just collapse, if you like, just like gravitational collapse. But where the perturbations come from and what is the spectrum, I think it is up for debate. I don't know if there is a particular model that is more important than the others. I don't know, Will, do you agree with that? I mean, this is my understanding of the situation right now.
So maybe I can ask another question. So how does this value of critical above which you find this instability of the axon stars? How does that compare to the values that I don't think might be interested for other types of phenomenology or axions? Or like what
Sorry, I didn't quite catch the question because there's a lot of echo and I'm just not quite getting what the question is. Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah, so I was just wondering how this value of the critical coupling parameter that you're finding, you know, above which you get instability axis on yourself, that compares to like the bounds on this parameter or values that you might want to consider for other types of phenomenology or axions.
You mean like this critical this value compared to models of axions? I mean, is that what your question is? Like, we have like some scaling for G critical as a function of MS, but if I understand your question correctly, you're asking whether or not what does it compare to other prediction of G crit, or is that what your question is?
Yeah, basically, like, is this G critical like sort of much larger than values that are typically considered, or much smaller?
I think that, well, I do not know a lot about the theory behind this. I'm the code monkey of this paper. David Doddy is the theory guy, and he said that these values are kind of reasonable for string derived axions. They are of order like M Planckish, so they are reasonable for models. But I don't really know a lot to be able to answer the question really. So I can just ape what he said, right? This is reasonable value. That these are not crazy values that is not important or is some regime that people don't care about.
Okay, so the reasonable absolute values above are below this stuff.
Sorry?
So the reasonable absolute values sort of above or below these critical values.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll be, wait, let me see. Are you saying that it would be useful to have these values for maybe I don't quite follow the question anymore. I try to understand the question again. I don't quite know. Sorry, I can't hear you. Sorry, can you say that again?
I think you answered my question, Eugene. Thanks.
Okay. I'm really sorry. It's just a little bit, the echo is really quite hard for me to hear. Maybe I need better speakers, really.
Yeah. Any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Eugene again for the very nice talk.
Thank you very much for having me.